Hello and welcome to this week's Convex Conversation with me, journalist Helen Fospero. On his Instagram, today's guest describes himself as a creator and purveyor of premium content. Chris Floyd is just that and much more. He's photographed the great and the good over the last two decades, capturing raw and stunning portraits of some of the greatest names in music, art, television and film. A rifle through his archives would reveal intimate portraits and brilliant outtakes of musicians like Iggy Pop, Debbie Harry, John Lee Hooker, Oasis, The Verve, actors Robert De Niro, Dame Sheila Hancock, Olivia Colman, Eva Green, Adrian Lester and Vicky McClure, artist David Hockney and Damien Hirst, and legends like Black Lives Matter hero Patrick Hutchinson and Sir David Attenborough. And most recently, Chris was invited to Kensington Palace to photograph the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge for their 10th wedding anniversary. Chris, I've been dying to catch up with you. How the devil are you? I haven't seen you for a long time.
Hi, Helen. It's so nice to be here. Thanks for having me on. I'm good, actually.
Very welcome. I see that you've been digging through your archives over the last few months while we've all had a bit more time on our hands. What have you been up to?
You know, obviously, there was a great chunk of time with nothing to do when everything just stopped, like it did for practically everyone. You know, in those situations, you can go downhill really quite quickly if you're not careful. In my garage, I've got dozens and dozens of big plastic storage boxes of film and contact sheets and prints from the last, well, really up to about 2007, which was the point at which I bought a digital camera. So everything from the beginning of time until 2007 was shot on film. So in the garage, I had all this stuff and, you know, lots of it I just hadn't looked at for years. And then some of it I didn't even realize I'd done until I was reunited with it. So I started just digging around. You know, it was a real mess. It was in vague alphabetical order by subject name, but, you know, it was a bit of a mess and didn't really have any way of just being able to lay it all out and take it all in. So the first thing I did was I got a neighbor of mine who's a carpenter. He built me a floor to ceiling, wall to wall shelving unit, and I was able to take it all out, alphabetize it on the shelves, and then there was space to look at it all and assess it. So that's what I just started doing. And then there's no like rhyme or reason to it. I would come in the morning, go to a random letter in the alphabet and pull something out. And sometimes I'd look at it and go, oh no, I can't see that. But then on other days I'd be like, oh yes, Christopher Reeve, 2004. Let's spend the day with him, you know, and that's what I do. I'd bought a film scanner. So now it's very affordable and easy to digitize analog materials in a way that maybe 5 or 10 years ago was much more time consuming and expensive. So that's another thing, is that the technology has advanced to a point where you can do this stuff at home, whereas 10 years ago, to do a really good digitized version of a piece of film, you need a really, really expensive film scanner that would run to like £50,000 or £60,000 to buy. But now you can get something for a grand that's really good.
You found some fantastic gems in there. I was looking through your Instagram. David Byrne, for example, from Talking Heads. That was a great shot, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's just one picture. You know, it was actually shot on a Polaroid, like a big, large format camera, but a Polaroid image where you get a Polaroid, but you also get a Polaroid negative, so you can fix that negative and make prints from it later. So that's what that was. And they don't make that anymore. It's gone now. It's obsolete. Can't buy it. Polaroid's sort of gone and doesn't really exist anymore. So it's an artifact from a time that has passed, in the same way that people don't really do things on glass plates anymore, you know. So it's just things like that that have a kind of emotional resonance if you're into photography like I am.
Was it a real trip down memory lane for you, being in the garage and looking through all these old things that you found all stashed away?
Yeah, of course it's a trip down memory lane. It's funny, isn't it, how as you get older, time becomes elastic, but it also becomes compressed, doesn't it, inside your head? Because I sort of date my becoming a professional photographer to about 1992, 93. It's probably when I started to just scrape a living out of it. So that's close to 30 years. And when I sort of close my eyes and look back over my shoulder in my head down the road of time, on some days it's an incredibly long road that just seems to stretch for miles into the past. And then on other days it's just really compressed and it just all squashed into one thing. You know, I can remember being maybe 10 years old in bed, and that would have been 1978, and just thinking about what the year 2000 would be like. So what would have been that? 22 years into the future. And I remember so clearly that moment of lying there and just thinking, it might as well have been a million years. And now 2000 is, well, almost the same distance into the past, so 21 years ago. And I'm just like, oh my God, I can remember a time when everything stretched out into the future and thinking, you know, I've got ages to go. And now I'm like, now it's the other way.
you and I are more or less the same age. I think I might be 2 years older than you. But I remember the same kind of thing, watching the Twin Towers fall in New York and walking back from our live position at 5 o'clock in the morning, New York time, and trying to sort of remember that moment and thinking one day this will feel like a very, very long time ago. And in September, on September the 11th this year, that will be 21 years ago. And that is terrifying, because then I add 21 to my age and think, oh my goodness, I can't possibly be that age in 21 years time, which went like a heartbeat. But your career, I suppose, similar to mine, you know, the stories I've done as a journalist, your career is actually there in photographs. And what makes me a little bit sad about mine is when I was on this entertainment beat, we didn't have the phones that we have now. So I've interviewed tons of people, but got no photographs. But you can go on this journey with yours, you know, when you choose to, I suppose. And what I love about your Instagram and knowing you is the time that you spend sharing with all of us the backstories. And you clearly take a lot of time to write that. It's not quick on Instagram, is it, when you're fiddling around with the little characters and things. But can you share a few stories, Chris, not look back necessarily into the deep and distant past, but which stories really stand out from your favourite subjects and your favourite shoots?
The first one is the Paul McCartney one, because he's so closely bound up for me. And A, wanted to be a photographer in the first place, and B, I'm like a massive fan. So when I was a kid, we had a dart room. The headmaster, actually, of my school, we used to have to do activities after school. So I picked photography. We had a dart room in a cellar, and the headmaster taught us how to process film and make prints. That was where it began, really. So I would have been maybe 11 then. But it was just a hobby. It wasn't like a meaningful hobby. It was just something I did that I quite enjoyed doing, but I didn't really think any more of it than sometimes I do photography, in the same way that sometimes I do drawing. You know, the moment of clarity was when I must have been about 14 or 15, and I saw in the school library this photography book on portraiture, and I was looking through it, and there was this David Bailey picture of John Lennon and Paul McCartney from the mid-60s, black and white, square frame. It's just black and white. It's got black suit jackets on, white shirts, black hair, white faces, white background. There's nothing in it. There's no other tones in it other than the black and the white. And the other thing that Bailey did in this picture that's always stuck with me is he had this really hypnotic way of photographing pairs of people, where he would put one person, he'd get them to tilt their head slightly one way, and the other person, he'd get them to tilt their head slightly the other way. It just created this sort of visual kind of flow. I just found very charismatic is the word, visually charismatic. Anyway, so I saw this picture and I just thought, oh, wow. You can do this with photography. It doesn't have to be weddings or high street family portraits, because at that time, most people's experience of photography would have been to either have like a high street portrait, which is what, you know, that's what you did then if you wanted a family picture, or a wedding. And that was the only time people really had any contact with photographers. So that's all I knew. And then I saw this and I was like, just absolutely hooked. And realized that, you know, you can do this with photography. And then, you know, that was the little doorway into this incredible room where I started to learn about it. So it was discovering this Bailey picture with Paul McCartney in it. And then also, I'm, you know, like a massive Beatles fan. My mum had all the records. So, you know, of course, that's how I discovered them. And then, you know, when I was maybe 11, we had this babysitter, this girl who was like maybe 14. And I really fancied her. And she used to come to our house to babysit. She was my friend's older sister. She was called Nicola. And I think it was the first girl I really fancied. She would come to our house and then she would always play the Beatles' Help album. So in my head, I associate Help with girls. And I just thought they looked so cool on the album cover, the band, you know, and the pictures on the back of the sleeve. So it's all bound up here in my sort of far memory. And so then when I finally get commissioned to photograph McCartney, which was in 2003, there's all that baggage from my past, which of course he doesn't know anything about and he doesn't care either and he's not interested. I didn't tell him any of this stuff. You know, so for me, this was like my whole life has been leading to this moment. And so I'm like, you better make it a good one then, if everything's led up to this point. He was rehearsing in the London Arena. He was using it as a rehearsal space with his band. And we were told to arrive at 8 o'clock in the morning and we'd have 2 hours to get ready, set up our stuff and then shoot him at 10 o'clock. So we were ready. We're ready for 10. He comes in at some point. His band were there already and they were on stage. They were just sort of jamming, rehearsing. And he comes in and he's sort of supposed to come and have his picture taken by me, but he sort of can't resist going to the band and just having a little play with them. He's like, oh, just give me a minute. He picks up his bass guitar and he just starts playing with them. And then it just went on and on for about, well, basically all day. I mean, there was a break for lunch, and then after lunch he just went back to wrestling. It was like he'd completely forgotten about me. But we are on the floor of the arena, you know, because he's rehearsing this empty arena. So you've got the stage and then you've got the whole floor, which ordinarily might have seating in it, but there was nothing there. The whole floor was completely open and empty. So it was like we had our pop-up photography studio 10 yards in front of the stage, and we just had our own sort of private show for the whole day. But I'm still quite anxious, even though I'm enjoying sitting watching Paul McCartney play Hey Jude. I'm still anxious, like, I've got to get my time with him. I've got to get my pictures. Oh, wow, he's playing Let It Be. Amazing. I've got to get my pictures, you know. And then it gets to the end of the day, and his PR guy was like, okay, Paul, we've got to do the shoot. And he's like, oh, God, yeah, sorry, so sorry. I forgot. I do apologize. You know, and he was really, really nice. And then I did maybe a minute and a half of pictures. And then he was like, okay, you've got enough, haven't you? I've got to go now because I'm doing this live show at the BBC, so I can't be late for that because it's live. But you've got enough, haven't you? And I was like, well, I don't really, you know, I came here, I was told I'd have half an hour with you, you've given me a minute and a half, I don't really have enough. And you know, we've been here all day, we were told to be ready at 10, and you know, it's been really nice watching you play, but I've got to get my pictures. And you know, the other thing was, I was living in New York at the time, and I'd come back to London to do this, and I sort of said to him in an almost kind of pleading way, I came all the way from New York for this. He obviously was aware that I had an English accent, so he couldn't quite understand what the New York thing was. And he was like, why have you come from New York? And I said, well, I live in New York. He was like, oh, do you? Oh, God, I love New York. We had a great time there when we first went over. Oh, wow. Oh, you really came from New York? And I said, yeah. And he goes, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. When are you going back? And I said, I'm going back on Tuesday. And I do remember very clearly this was a Friday. So you're going back Tuesday? I said, yeah. He said, so, okay, what are you doing on Monday? And I was like, nothing. Okay, why don't you come back on Monday? Leave all your stuff here over the weekend. I'll give you half an hour on Monday. So I was like, is that a deal? He's like, yeah, deal. We shook hands on it. And, you know, this is the thing. When I wrote that story up, the title of the piece is what I said to him at the point we had the handshake, which was, okay, have a good weekend. I'll see you Monday. And he's like, yeah, you too. See you Monday. In my head, it was this really nice moment where we were just two guys who worked together. And we were just bidding each other a nice weekend. And I'll see you Monday.
So how did you get your break into photographing musicians? You were embedded, weren't you, with the Verve in the late 90s. Was that perhaps the sort of moment when your career turned in that particular way? And because musicians have played a big part, haven't they, in your past?
Yes. When I first got into it, the stuff that really excited me was album covers and movie posters and just cultural stuff, really. You know, I'm like 17, 18, 19. You know, that's what I'm into. I'm into records, books and films. So I want to do work that is on the cover of records, books and films. So music just happened to be the easiest route in, because at that time there were, off the top of my head, I can think of 7 regular music publications just in the UK alone. You know, you had Enemy, Melody Maker, Q, Vox, Select. Then there's all the more specialist ones, like all the heavy metal ones, Smash Hits. So you had that, and then you had also other mags, like more lifestyle kind of fashion-y mags, like The Face, Arena, Sky. It was such a massive, thriving, healthy magazine culture that it was really, really possible, if you put your mind to it and were able to get in the door, that you could shoot for magazines in a way that isn't possible now, and also earn a sustainable living from it, enough to pay your rent and, you know, feed yourself and stuff. So music was the thing, because there were so many magazines, so it was just a sheer like numbers game, really, in a way. So I would have my portfolio, and in the front of the magazine you've got the masthead with the staff and the address and phone number and stuff, and you just ring up, you look down the list, you find out who the art director is or the picture editor. You know, hello, I'm a photographer, I'm probably the 9 millionth person that's called you today, but I'd love to come and see you. And it's just perseverance and just getting people in the right mood at the right moment on the right day. So you just go and see people with your portfolio. So that was music. You know, if I lived in LA, I probably would have been more likely to have been filmed, because that's where the film industry is. So, but it wasn't like I had this burning desire for it. It's got to be music and nothing else. It's just music was the most prevalent subject material at that time, combined with the number of magazines that were serving it.
You brought out a beautiful book, I think it was 2017, of your photographs with the Verve. What was it like being on tour with them and being part of them for a while?
That was the culmination of it all, I suppose, which in hindsight was an incredibly short period of time. I really started working for magazines properly in 1994, and my Verve thing was 1997. although I had met them in 1994. That's how I met them. I met them on a story for a magazine, and I went with a journalist, and we spent a week with them on tour. And we went from Vegas to Denver to Kansas to Minneapolis in a week. So that's 4 gigs in 4 cities, and we traveled with them. So that's how I met them. That was 94. And then I saw them for that week, and that was it. And then I bumped into one of them in late 96 when they were recording an album in Chiswick at Olympic Studios, which is, it's a cinema now, Olympic. I just happened to bump into one of them in a, like a newsagent's a few doors down from Olympic, just by coincidence. And he was like, oh, how you doing? We're in Olympic. We're recording. Come in. So I went with him. You know, they played me this song they were working on called Bittersweet Symphony. And Olympic had these enormous speakers in the studio on either side of the desk that were just incredibly loud. And they played me that at full volume. You know, and it was a Friday night, about a week before Christmas, like the 18th of December. It was dark, cold, wet, raining, grim, dreary, horrible winter's day. And then to go inside this place, to go from the world outside, which was like that, into the studio, and then hear that tune was pretty knockout. And so I said, oh my God, this is amazing. And then they played me some more stuff, and that was great. And then I said, I'd love to come back and just take some pictures of you working, which they were fine with. So I would just come and go on my own terms, really, and just do stuff in the studio. And then they sort of finish. It was never a plan. It was just like, I would just turn up, you know, every 3 or 4 weeks or a day and see them. And then, you know, when the album was finished and then they started promoting it and doing artwork, I did bits of the artwork. And then there was a short British tour for a week, sort of summer of 97, which I went on. And then there was an American tour a bit later in the year for 3 or 4 weeks that I went on. And it was just sort of, it just happened. By the end of that American tour, which would have been almost a year after I first heard Bittersweet in the studio, I was like, well, that's enough. You know, I've kind of done this now, and they've had enough of me, and I've had enough of them. And the other thing you kind of learn from going on tour is it is a fascinating world. In psychologically, being on tour with a band is so interesting, because you're in this self-made bubble, and what goes on inside the bubble is completely disconnected from the outside world. You go on a bus to a hotel, to a gig, to the bus, to a hotel, to the gig, to a bus, and so on. And you stop. You know, the bus stops to refuel, and you have truck stops, particularly in America, and you buy weird stuff in truck stops at 3 o'clock in the morning. But it's a strange kind of world. You can see how young people in bands can go mad, not necessarily in an insane, like crazy, physically mad way, but it just becomes, it can become very introverted and a kind of slightly paranoid place to be inside that bubble. You know, you've got young people who aren't necessarily fully emotionally developed in a confined space, a bus, a hotel, a gig, a dressing room, for weeks and weeks at a time, with very little daylight and very little fresh air. So it was an object lesson in how to be when you're in a confined space in intimately creative circumstances. And that was what I learned from that. And it's only in hindsight, maybe a few years after that, that I really realized that, because then I would go into other situations where, you know, I've been around politicians, say, where you're in confined spaces with them. And yet what I learned from that whole year with them was know when to speak, know when to shut up, know when to leave the room, know when to put your camera down. What you learn is when to not do things, when to be invisible, when to be quiet. And that is how it's possible for you to be absorbed in situations where people don't mind you being there. Because the thing about being a photographer is that you're a tourist in other people's realities. And it's okay for me, I can leave. You know, I did a trip to Uganda a few years ago on behalf of Save the Children, where I went to photograph all these children who had been abducted by the Lord's Resistance Army, which is this guy, Joseph Kony, who's been waging this kind of guerrilla war against the Ugandan government for 25, 30 years. And they have this terrible habit of raiding villages, abducting all the boys, forcing them to become soldiers in the LRA, Lord's Resistance Army. It's awful. And I did this trip for Save the Children where they had set up kind of safe houses or safe camps or small kind of hostels for children who had been abducted, 8, 9 years old, forced to become soldiers, given guns, kill people, maim people. And then they had either escaped or been rescued in sort of counter-attacks by the Ugandan army, where they have managed to find these kids and get them back. So I went to quite a few places with Save the Children and photographed these kids. And, you know, that's their life. And I'm there for a week. And I'm certainly in that situation. I'm a tourist in their reality. And I'm very conscious of that. And I'm very conscious about how to be sensitive around people. But also at the same time, I've got a job to do, which is I've got to produce compelling work that people are going to look at. And sometimes that means, well, you know yourself from being a journalist, Sometimes that means being a bit more intrusive than you would ordinarily like to be if you weren't doing your job. But sometimes you have to do that in order to serve your ultimate master, who I think is posterity. That's who we work for, people like us. You know, we're employed by posterity. That's our boss, because we're here to document things, good and bad, so that people understand and know them in the future when we're gone, you know, because ultimately that's what history is.
You've been in the presence of greatness too in the art world. I'm thinking David Hockney's studio. And I think I'm right in saying you said it was one of the greatest thrills of your life. Can you give us a little taste of what that felt like for you to be there and what he was like?
So he has a place in sort of Kensington, but not the nice bit. It's like the cheaper bit of Kensington. It's not the glitzy bit of Kensington. But he's got this house come studio, little kind of Edwardian development. They were built for artists, I think, because the roof of one part of it was a huge skylight window, like north-facing skylight window, which is like what all painters want. And I think they were built as artists' studio / residences. And I think he's owned that for a very long time, certainly since the 1960s, I'm guessing. I parked in this little ordinary street. You go through a gate, this little kind of ornamental gate, and you're in this kind of Edwardian garden square, down a path, and then his front door is sort of just a normal front door. And I knocked on the door and he came. He answered the door with a cigarette in his hand. He sort of mumbled something to me. He was expecting me, so he knew I was coming. And then we went in, and so he had an assistant. He's got an assistant who showed me around, and then he took me to the studio bit. So we sat up in his studio. But the thing about that was, the night before the shoot, I had a dream. What my dream was just this Jaguar racing green color, you know, British racing green. It was all I saw in my dream. And when I woke up the day of the shoot, there's a company in Wimbledon who make canvases for the photographic and film industry. Beautiful canvas backdrops, and you can just rent them by the day or by the week or whatever. And I called them up and I said, look, have you got anything green that's like, you know, Jaguar racing green color? And they were like, oh yeah, yeah. On their website, there's like, each canvas has got a code number. So he says, go in the website, go to the search box and type in this code number. So I did. And it was exact green I had dreamt, this green thing. I was like, that's what I want. Is it available today? Yes, it's available today. Can you deliver it to Kensington by 4 o'clock this afternoon? Yes, we can. So they sent over this canvas backdrop. When Hockney answered the door, he was wearing a green cardigan that was exactly the same color as that canvas backdrop. And he was holding a green lighter that was only a slightly different shade of green. So I was like, oh my God, this is it. So, you know, we set up the backdrop and he came, and he still had the lighter in his hand. He was sort of like, it was a plastic push button lighter, you know, and he was just constantly clicking it. So that was the picture, just all this green. And it's never happened to me before, but I dreamt that picture night before, because if I had not had that dream, I wouldn't have bothered taking that backdrop or even bringing a backdrop. We had this really friendly but spirited debate about photography versus drawing. I said something about, you know, photography, and then he said something about drawing in response. And I said, do you really think drawing versus photography? Do you really think that? And I remember his response so clearly. He said, photography doesn't come close. It doesn't even come close to drawing. And then I ended it there with him. I was like, yeah, okay, I'm not going to argue with that. I'm not going to argue with you about that. My photography versus my drawing is a different story, but my photography versus your drawing, that's a different thing entirely.
It's also a different story. It's not often that we see pictures of you, but my absolute favourite of you is in a white boiler suit, hanging out, as you do, in Damien Hirst's studio a couple of years ago. That must have been a lot of fun, and I'm guessing the boiler suit was connected to paint and lots of.
Yeah, so I went to his studio, which is on the Thames, and it's sort of high up. It's maybe a third or fourth floor of this building. So it has a lot of daylight in it. And when we arrived, he gave us these boiler suits, like new ones in a packet, to put this on, because everything in here is covered in paint and you're going to get paint on you. So we put the boiler suits on, and then sure enough, yeah, you can't move around that place without getting wet paint on you. So that's how I ended up with paint on me. I've still got paint on my camera strap from him. So I've got splat, and on the camera, I've got splatters of paint.
Yeah. That's probably worth something, you know. Got an original Damien Hirst there. There is, with your portraits, there's, and we've talked about this in person, for me, there's always a rawness and an intimacy and a sense of seeing that person in a way that perhaps one hasn't seen them before, which has always made me slightly nervous of you ever photographing me, because they are some of the really raw pictures. How do you get that out of people? Because you haven't always got ages with people. How do you make them feel so comfortable? It feels like they're very giving in your company.
doing photographic portraiture, it is like a form of speed dating. What am I trying to do? I'm trying to achieve a result that has some sense of intimacy to it. How I get there, there is no defined route for arriving at that intimacy. But the start point and the end point, I know what they are. The end point is some kind of sense of intimacy. The start point is a situation that is so supremely artificial, it couldn't be more fake. There's backdrops, there's lights, there's assistants, there's makeup artists, maybe there's stylists, set builders even. This could not be a less real situation if you try. But what you're trying to get within the frame is the complete opposite of that. So I know where I'm starting and I know where I've got to get to. And then from that start point, it's just a question of figuring out the route in the way that, you know, you, an animal goes through the forest and just knows how to get to water or whatever. You're just kind of sniffing your way through the forest looking for the water. And, you know, it's just a question of talking, sometimes talking lots, actually sometimes not talking at all, depending on what the person's like. And then also listening. You know, if they talk back to you, you've got to listen to what they say and you've got to process that and be able to respond to it so that the conversation can kind of move forward in a fluid way, like a river. When it works, you get to a point where the person, even if it's for 5 seconds or 5 minutes, you can tell they've just completely forgotten why they're there, because you've got them to this point where you're absorbed with each other and they've just, all the other stuff just has become almost invisible and it's melted away. And that's the moment when you know you're going to get something from them. This whole thing about, oh, you know, seeing the soul of the sitter and all that, that's quite a dated perception of what good portraiture is. You know, people are multidimensional. You don't get their soul on camera. You just get some sense of them in a moment that is truthful. You get a truthful facet of them. You might get many truthful facets in several pictures, but that's sort of it, really, is you're just having a conversation with them, which is talking, and I'm just doing my job. It's like the way you watch an amazing musician play. You know, when you watch a concert pianist play, they don't need to look at the keyboard. They know what their fingers are doing. And it's totally like that. It's like, I don't need to look at the keyboard. I know where everything is on my camera. I don't need to look at it. I can do it without looking at it. For every second I don't have to be absorbed with the technicalities is a second I can spend focusing my attention on you and the conversation that we're having. And that photograph, in the end, it's like a record of the conversation. It's like, we had a conversation. Here's a picture of it. The end.
That's a lovely way to think about it. Vicky McClure's been very big in all our households recently, or 15 million of us watching the end of Line of Duty. You've described her as the greatest human being to come out of Nottingham since Robin Hood, which is a fantastic description. She's one of your favourites, isn't she, to photograph? What's she like?
A, she's a fantastic human being. B, she's a brilliant, talented actress. So, I mean, I fell in love with her when I saw her in This Is England, you know, when she was the skinhead girl. And the thing that struck me when I saw her in This Is England was she's got this deadly combination of brunette hair and blue eyes, which is just killer on camera. I love photographing actresses because really good actresses, they're just aware of themselves physically and they're also aware of how light works on them. Good actresses know where the good light is. You know, there's another one I photographed only once, was Naomi Watts. That was 2006, I think. That was the first time I photographed an actress and it really hit me how good she was at what she does, because we've shot in this house in East London. I did this lighting. She came from hair and makeup. And I remember very clearly, she looked around at the lighting and she just went, yeah, okay, I got it. Meaning she understood what I was doing. It's like dancing. That's what it must feel like if you can dance and you've got an amazing dance partner. Vicky McClure is the same. 3 times I've shot her and I just find it's like, oh, we pick up where we left off. She's really nice to me.
That always helps.
She's very giving. She seems to enjoy the process. She's very self-confident in a way that's completely spellbinding and charming. There's no vanity to it. She's very comfortable, it seems, with who she is and what she is. And she's got no problem showing that to the camera.
And Eva Green's another of your favourites. I like the sound of the shoot you did with the soundtrack to Janet Baker's Have I Lost Track of the World? That sounded amazing. I played that the other day when I was reading up on you.
Well, that was just a one-off thing. She was quite tricksy, I would say. A little bit aloof, a little bit haughty, a little bit above it all. But when I put that music on, it seemed to pique her interest. And she was like, what's this? And so I told her what it was. And she changed in that moment and became much more collaborative. I think quite often you can also have actors or actresses who are very defensive and insecure or not necessarily confident. You know, I've got a few actor friends and musician friends. And, you know, when people like me go into situations with people like that, they're the star, they're the famous person. I'm slightly in awe of them in that I think that everything about their life is peachy and great. And I'm just some scummy serf who's been allowed through the gates of the palace with his bowl. But talking to people I do know socially or privately, you know, you realize that they have imposter syndrome too. You know, they feel like they don't deserve to be there either. And that's something that only quite recently I realized was that, oh, yeah, maybe they might feel inferior in my presence. I don't mean that in a vain way. I mean that, you know, we've all got our hang-ups and our issues and we're not necessarily comfortable with new company. You know, and that's another thing about this job is that when you're photographing these people, you've never met them before and you're strangers. And that's what I said the thing earlier about speed dating. To put it bluntly, you've got to find a way to charm people in a way that just makes them feel comfortable with you, or like they've known you for a long time, or just feel warm in your presence, you know, comfortable. And that's what so much of it is about, people skills.
You mentioned there slipping through the palace gates, and I know that you probably won't be able to say anything about one of your most recent shoots that we've all seen, but it would be foolish of me not to say anything about it. You did slip through the gates of Kensington Palace. And you did photograph Kate and William for their 10th wedding anniversary. And given the fact that I'm sure you're not going to be able to tell me anything they said or much about it at all, that must be another example of, well, of people that we all feel we sort of know, I suppose, don't we? We've grown up with. But yet you have those few minutes to create that warmth. And it was a great honour to do it. I'm trying to think of a way of phrasing it so that you can answer without having to give anything away.
Of course, it was a great honour. It's pretty powerful thing to be asked to do something like that. I mean, the strange thing about it was that the day I was contacted by the palace, I was in Cambridge that day. And that was also the first day in my entire life that I'd ever been to Cambridge.
That's a bit like the Green Story, isn't it?
And I got an email from someone at the palace when I was in Cambridge. It was absolutely bizarre, that coincidence, you know. So in that sense, you know, there are such things as fate, maybe.
Yeah, well, they were beautiful portraits. And I'm guessing you had a lovely conversation because Kate, of course, has become quite the photographer with her children. So I'm sure it was a lovely experience. But Hollywood royalty, I mean, you've done lots of Hollywood royalty too. I'm thinking of people like Robert De Niro. I mean, there's a legend. Was that a fun shoot?
Yeah, De Niro, I was very intimidated, obviously. We shot that in a hotel in London, and he was obviously also having some sort of businessy meetings because there were some sort of lawyery type people in the room. Then he had some time allotted to do this portrait thing with me. But in the middle of it, one of the businessy people came out to ask him or talk to him about something. And then it just went on for a while, and I was kind of sitting there politely waiting for them to finish their conversation. I'm just thinking, I've got to get him back. I've lost him. But I had this whole thing in my head about what to call him. Because when he had first come in the room and shook my hand, he never said his name. So I said, hi, nice to meet you. I'm Chris. He shook my hand and he just went, hey, hey. So he'd never said his name. So I didn't know what I should call him. And he's having this thing with the lawyer or whatever. And I'm just thinking in my head, what should I call him? Robert? I don't know if that's too formal. Bobby? I know Scorsese. When I've seen Scorsese talk about him, Scorsese always calls him Bobby. But that seems too familiar. I'm not on the same level of familiarity with him as Martin Scorsese is. Bob. I've heard actors who've worked with him call him Bob. Bob seems right. This is all in my head. I'll go with Bob. So I'm like, hey, Bob! And then he just breaks away from there and he looks at me and he just gives me this little salute. I'm like, yes, sir! Like, as in, you know, I'm sorry, I'm back, you know. Saluted. And I snapped this picture of him doing the salute, which was my favourite picture from the shoot, was just this moment of him kind of acknowledging me with a salute. Apart from that, he does laugh a lot. His laugh is how impressionists do his laugh. So impressionists that do their impression of Robert De Niro laughing when his face kind of screws up, that's how he laughs in real life. It was like watching an impressionist do an impression of Robert De Niro done by Robert De Niro, is how it was.
That's funny. When you started out, you shot on film. And I remember very clearly at one point you said that digital loomed over you like a gloomy pixelated cloud. And you wrote on your Instagram quite a moving piece, actually, about what that transition was like from film to digital. Can you summarise how that was? Because you'd spent 20 years learning the intricacies of film. And then I think you realised, didn't you, that commercially you had to embrace digital, which now you seem to love.
It wasn't like we were plodding along doing film all those years thinking, oh, there was going to be some, I mean, I guess maybe more technologically minded people knew that digital would arrive one day, but it was never really in my head. When the digital thing came along, these things, they gather pace really slowly, don't they? You know, if you do a graph of it, it would be a very shallow line for a long time. And then probably an 18 month to 2 year period, suddenly all the stuff becomes more affordable, more available. Clients want it. Advertising agencies want it. Publishers want it because for them, it's a big cost saving, not having to pay for film and printing and FedExing things all over the world, you know, physical artifacts, got to go on a plane and be sent somewhere. So when it gathered pace incredibly quickly. At that point, you just think, oh, for God's sake, I've just spent 20 years learning how to use that, and now I've got to learn how to use this. So there was that. There was the sort of logistical side of it, which was like, ugh, how annoying. And now I've got to do this whole new thing. You know, I'm really happy with the cooker I've got, and now you're making me buy this new cooker. Then there's the emotional side of it and the sort of human side, which was that in the days of film, of course, everyone would take their film to a film lab, you drop it off, or you'd hang around and wait, and then you go back to collect your film, and you'd always bump into other photographers or other people from ad agencies or people that you might want to work for. The film lab was the nexus of where everything happened in my game. And it was where you could find people, make friends, make contacts, have a laugh. You know, it was the social side of things as much as the technical professional side of things. And then digital just killed all that off. That one whole massive element of it that was vanished, basically, which is the sad side. Just maybe being in the film lab on a Friday afternoon and you go in to collect your contact sheets, and then it's sort of 4 o'clock and there's a few other people in there, and then you go to the pub, and then you end up having conversations that you didn't know you were going to have. You know, the space for unintended pleasant consequences was killed off by digital. What I don't miss is the amount of money I spent on parking and the amount of time I spent on public transport or in traffic driving, going to and from the lab. So, you know, now I can do a shoot, go home, edit it at home, send it in, obviously, via the internet. That's all great. I just miss making friends. And there's lots of people I'm friendly with on things like Instagram, other photographers who I've never met. I don't even know what they look like, but we talk to each other but never meet, you know. And that's really sad. It's a shame, because you're sort of breeding a generation who completely miss out on all the human interaction, social side of what it means to be part of a culture and part of a professional culture. Yeah.
You photographed Black Lives Matter hero Patrick Hutchinson for the cover of Men's Health magazine when he was just coming into the public eye after that iconic Reuters image of him saving the life of a white man at the rally in London. Thanks to you introducing me, Patrick's become a great friend, and I'm involved with his charity now, so thank you very much for that. But what an incredible human being to have as a subject, and what a face and cheekbones. I mean, Patrick's unbelievably looking, isn't he? But also, what a soul that man has.
It's pretty clear within 35 seconds of meeting him that he has a profound sense of himself, morally, intellectually, and physically. When you're in his presence, you really know you're in his presence. There's a stillness about him, actually. So the thing I said earlier about talking to people when you're photographing them, the thing I realized with him, actually, was that I didn't really need to say much at all, because his presence in front of the camera was doing everything already. And I actually just needed to shut up and get on with it. When I photographed, it was very quiet. Although there were a lot of people in the studio, what was happening between me and him was very quiet. Apart from me giving the odd bit of direction, just turn this way, or show me your hands, or put your head down or up, or close your eyes. There was very little I needed to say to him, because he knows who he is already. My job really was just to be true to that, I guess.
You certainly were. They were beautiful portraits. Just leave us, if you would, with a couple more stories from the intro. So in the intro, I mentioned people like Iggy Pop. And I know that's an old portrait from a long time ago that you've just put out on Instagram. But boy, that was a great picture.
The thing that I do with my little stories of shoots is quite often I'm able to take a small morsel, one lead sentence, one exchange, one look, one tiny thing, and it's almost like use filmic technique, slow it right down. It's almost like writing it in slow motion. So you take this one incident that in real life may have only played out over 30 seconds or even less, and in the way I write it, I'll slow it right down, and it becomes the entire nexus of the whole thing. So with Iggy, we're in this hotel room. I said to him, why don't you treat this room like it's a prison exercise yard? I don't know why I said that, but I did. He started immediately to take his shirt off, and he's wearing these black trousers and black boots. He takes his shirt off and he just started doing these kind of lunges like he was exercising and flexing. Really, really theatrical, but brilliant. And then we were interrupted because this woman came in the room who I turned out was his girlfriend. She was kind of an incredible looking lady. She comes in and she just says, I'm going to go out shopping. I'll see you later. And he just looked at her. Just his voice is amazing. He just goes, see you later, baby. And he gave her a look that I described as something like intimate, obscene, threatening, and long. Something like that was the way he looked at her. She left the room. And then I said to him, wow, she's pretty amazing, in a sort of male to male conspiratorial way. And he just said, you want to know something else? I was like, yeah, sure. And he kind of waggled his finger at me, like, come closer. So I sort of moved closer, and then we're like 18 inches apart. And he just goes, I also have a really cool automobile. It was like, I've got a really cool girl, and I've got a really cool car. So
What a lovely story to end on. Where are you headed today? I know that this is early morning and you're whizzing out with your camera today, aren't you?
Well, I live in Oxfordshire, which is east side of the Cotswolds, and I'm going to the west side of the Cotswolds near Cheltenham to photograph a well-known quiz show host from the past.
Ah, and that's all he's going to say, and I'm not going to tempt any more out of you. Am I allowed to guess? No.
Yeah, you can have it. I mean, it's Anne Robinson.
Oh, well, she'll be fine. Have you photographed her before?
No, never.
I did a little bit of Watchdog with Anne Robinson, and I think you're going to have a great time. Get her to tell you the story of when she was offered the quiz show and why the crumpled up letter offering her the programme is on the wall of her toilet, framed.
Oh, shall I ask her that?
Ask her that. I'm sure she'll tell you that story. It's a very, very good story. Chris, thanks ever so much for making time, and particularly on a day when you're racing off to do a shoot, because I know, you know, you have a lot on your mind, but it's been an absolute pleasure, and I shall continue to enjoy your stories on Instagram. But yeah, thanks for making time for us. It's been great.
Oh, thanks, Helen. It's lovely to see you again.
I know. We'll have to catch up properly at some point. You've been listening to photographer Chris Floyd, whose portraits of Kate and William, actually, you may well have seen to mark their 10th anniversary. And if you're not already, do follow Chris on Instagram at Chris Floyd, because I'm sure you'll enjoy the writing that he does, along with the fantastic portraits that are on there. So download and subscribe to our series at convex.podbean.com, or search The Convex Conversation on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts, or simply ask Alexa. I'll be back with another great guest next week, so see you then.